The art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am so happy to be joined by Lawrence W. Reed of LawrenceWReed.com. He is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Mr. Reed, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Keith. Thanks for having me. And by the way, I semi-retired from FEE as president a couple of years ago, so I'm president emeritus now.
Okay. Well, thank you for the clarification. What does it mean to support economic freedom?
Well, I think it means that you recognize that each of us is a unique individual with his or her own talents and abilities and goals and ambitions. And among those goals and ambitions for many people is entrepreneurship, starting a business, hiring people, creating wealth, inventing things and so forth. And all of that requires economic freedom. That means that you are not controlled by politicians in terms of what you can produce, what you can sell it for, who you can trade with, where you can sell it. As long as you do no harm to another person's life or rights or property or contracts, you should be free economically, and I think also in every other way, to be yourself.
There is an excellent book called Anything Peaceful that I got from the Foundation for Economic Education. On page 33, it says, as the individual has no moral right to use aggressive force against another or others, a moral limitation common to all individuals, it follows that he cannot delegate that which he does not possess. What is Leonard E. Reed talking about in that paragraph?
Okay, Leonard Reed, no relation to me. He spelled his name R-E-A-D. But I knew him in the last 7 years or so of his life. Remarkable man, great lover of liberty, and the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education. He was establishing in that paragraph a very important principle that should govern our relationship, each of us, between ourselves and between ourselves and the state. And he was essentially saying, the state doesn't have a right that you don't first have as an individual and choose to delegate to the state, specifically the right to self-defense. And if the state has any legitimate function at all, it is surely to protect the lives and the property of the people over which it governs. And that's a right that they each individually have already as a matter of their very existence.
Now, very often we hear discussions as to what should be in public hands and what should be in private hands. What do you see as both the economic difference and the principal difference between an industry being public versus privatized?
Oh, okay. Well, a public industry, and this is the conventional definition. At the moment, I can't think of why I would disagree with this definition, although I don't like public industries. But that essentially means that an industry is under the direct control of those in political power. It means, now some people say, well, but what if it's a local power company that's owned by the city? Is that any different? And I would say, no, that's a government in that case is a very local one, but it's still part of the political process if it's a public industry. And the difference between that and a private industry or private company is that a private firm is owned and managed by the people who have a stake in it, who created it, who bought it, who own shares in it, or one way or another possess a legal, moral, and economic title to the operation of that firm.
Now, when it comes to private, many people will associate this with greed and only looking after money at the expense of people's feelings, people's dignity, the environment, long-term effects. If I want to make sure people's dignity is respected, the longer-term effects of what I'm doing is going to be beneficial to people at large, why should I advocate free market economics as opposed to socialism?
Well, you know, socialism is the use of force. Quite often people fall for it because they've been told that it's little more than sharing and caring and giving and, you know, helping people out. But there's more of that, more sharing, caring, giving, and helping people out under capitalism than there ever is under socialism. So there's a vast difference there. But having something that's yours, that is private property, although some people seem to think that that's greedy and selfish, that's actually the winning formula for the production of goods and services that benefit everybody. You just don't work as hard for the state, the distant state, than you do for yourself or your family or your friends, your associates. If it's yours, you tend to take care of it. Whereas if it belongs to everybody or nobody, it tends to fall apart. So if you want to find an arrangement that is really antisocial, just take private property out of the equation. Make everything public, that is to say, under the control of politicians, and you'll not only sooner or later destroy that resource, you will demoralize the people who were responsible for creating it in the first place.
So often the people lecturing us about greed advocate the philosophy of statism, which in America today consists of the state coercively taking about $5 trillion coercively every year with the threat of putting people in jail if they don't chip in. How has that been seen as compassion while voluntarily funded competition is seen as greedy, evil, and dog-eat-dog?
Yeah, it really is. You have to shake your head at it. You know, how did that ever come about? I think Thomas Sowell put it well when he said he could not understand why it's greed when you want to keep it for yourself because you created it and it's yours, but it's not greed if somebody else wants to take it from you, someone else who didn't create it or have anything to do with its creation in the first place. You know, this really is an age-old fallacy here. I mean, we can point to authors and people of influence over the last century and a half who augmented and expounded on that flawed reasoning. But it goes way back. You know, the first time some caveman took a club to another because he wanted his property, even if he felt it was for the common good, that was socialism. And we've always been in this fight. Get people to respect the lives and the rights and the property of their fellow citizens. And whether you dress it up as, oh, we're going to help people, or whether you, like the common thief, don't really care, you just want to take it because you want it. Either way, it's a violation of an inherent right that each and every person comes into this world possessing, and that is the right to mix your labor with unowned natural resources or resources you trade for freely and make them your own.
Excellent. You wrote a book called Are We Good Enough for Liberty? On page 12, you say a person's character is nothing more and nothing less than the sum of his choices. You can't choose your height or race or many other physical traits, but you fine-tune your character every time you decide right from wrong and what you personally are going to do about it. Why should I care about character when I already have people in Washington, D.C. making sure my society is safe and acting justly and making sure I'm taken care of and they make the laws for me? Why should I care about character?
Well, in the way you framed that question, Keith, you put a lot of faith in people in Washington. And it does, of course, I know that that's not your real view. But any person who's half awake and watches what goes on in Washington has got to be seriously disappointed. I mean, these are not Mother Teresa's running around just trying to do wonderful things for you. I mean, these are self-interested people who possess a monopoly of legal force. And every time that's employed or bestowed upon somebody, it corrupts them. As Lord Acton told us, power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So you could take a perfectly good person and give them power. And in almost every case, sooner or later, usually very quickly, they will be corrupted. They will use the power against other people and to satisfy some thirst, some yearning, some ambition that they have themselves. That's just the way people are. It's all the more reason why you want to minimize the concentration of power and try to direct it to the most constructive purposes possible. And tell people, hey, you got to keep an eye on it because it's a very volatile, powerful, and destructive thing. Character is important because everything flows from it. I get asked a lot of times by audiences, what do you think the most important issue is in society? And they expect me to say things like, well, it's taxes or it's opioids or it's COVID or it's crime or, you know, things that are big and important. But I always tell them this, the number one issue here and everywhere, now and for all time, always has been and will remain forever, personal character. Why? Everything flows from it. I mean, what makes you up, what motivates you, the values you hold, that gets manifested in real life in your relationships with other people. If you, for instance, are a very honest and responsible and courageous and patient person, one who's humble enough to realize that running his own life is a full-time job, let alone trying to run somebody else's, well, then you're a person of character and you can live in peace with other people. But the moment you let your character slip, what does that mean? That means, well, now you're not as honest as you used to be. You lie on occasion when it's for your short-term personal benefit, or you've lost your humility. Now you think you can plan other people better than they can plan their own lives, or you're no longer as responsible as you used to be. That would show up as, you know, you demanding other people give you a bailout, subsidize you, give you something, whether they want to or not. So the absence of character, I think, is deadly. The presence of it at least allows people to be free. And I don't know of any society in all of history that lost its character, and by that I mean character in a positive way, that lost its character and kept its liberties. So if liberty means anything to you, you should be out there beating the drum for personal character to convince people that, hey, be an honest person, be responsible, don't invade or abuse the rights and lives and choices of other people.
Now, so often people will say that the existence of greed, corruption, selfishness is something that exists in this primitive state of nature. Therefore, we need a state as a mechanism to come in and correct these shortcomings built into the human condition. How do you respond?
Well, greed is just as present, even more so, in any primitive state of socialism. Or even if there is such a thing as an advanced state of socialism, it's present there too. I mean, socialism, or, you know, empowering politicians, doesn't do away with the desire on the part of individuals to satisfy their self-interest. It simply channels it into destructive directions. You know, in a free society, I'm interested in myself and my family and people I know and the values that I hold. But if I want to support those things, I have to find a way to peacefully acquire wealth through trade and free association with other people. I can't put a crown on my head and wrap a robe around myself and say, I'm the queen or I'm the king, give me your money. Or I'm a politician who wants to do good for other people, so give me your money. I can't do that in a free society. So those who say that if you socialize things, if you concentrate political power in do-gooders in government, that you somehow do away with greed, I think they're just blowing smoke. I mean, no, they're not doing away with greed. They're just giving a handful of power-hungry people an opportunity to use their own personal greed in very destructive directions.
I think that's the great lesson that the Foundation for Economic Education is constantly promoting, that even if we have someone who is, let's just say for the sake of argument, Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, terrible, evil, selfish, greedy people. Well, the only way that they are able to build great fortunes is by meeting consumer demand, not just appealing to a small wealthy elite as politicians would for campaign contributions at the expense of the taxpayer. They meet mass consumer demand, whether it's through cars or distribution of steel, lowering the production cost, because everything we have is used with steel. Rockefeller and, lowering oil prices, or Vanderbilt getting steamships and, you know, the first railroads going to mass production. So we could live like kings once did. Why do you think that so many people will use the fear of being exploited by the rich if there isn't a state. Why is that so often a justification for the expansion of the state?
Well, there's something in the human heart, if not every human's heart, at least a great many of them, that seems to want to vilify someone else, especially if that someone else has more things, regardless of the reasons why. I think that's a very negative and but powerful influence, this whole idea of envy, of looking upon people who have more as sort of automatically under suspicion. They must have done some harm to some people. But you look at the names that you've mentioned, like Rockefeller or Carnegie, they didn't swoop in and take over something that had previously existed and then contract the supply of it so as to get a higher price. They've massively added to the wealth of society. Rockefeller in 1920 was producing far more oil products than he was in 1900 or in 1880. I mean, he vastly expanded the quantity of a very valuable good and found an awful lot of willing customers. But there's still the streak in some people that goes way back, maybe to cavemen, that says, "No, you got more than me. Therefore, instead of trying to find how I too can be as productive, I just want to swipe it from you." That's a terrible motivation that people have to resist and have to fight. It's antisocial. It's a perfect prescription for chaos, destruction, and impoverishment.
What is the zero-sum fallacy in economics?
That's the old notion that, whenever there's a trade, it takes different forms, by the way. This may not be the only form that the zero-sum idea takes, but there was a prevailing feeling for a long time, up until a few hundred years ago, that whenever there was a trade, there had to be a loser. That one person's gain was automatically another person's loss. Well, it was the early economists, people like Adam Smith, 250 years ago, who said, wait a minute, no, trade is every bit as productive as production itself, because each person engages in trade, not because he intends to be just as well off afterwards as he was before. What's the purpose of that? I mean, you engage in trade because you think that you're going to be better off. And that's true not only of you, but the person you're trading with. It's a plus-plus game, not a zero-sum game. So there's a lot of that in economics. And that, it shows up in that old perspective on trade. You take that to a global perspective. There are people who think, well, if one country is doing well, it's only because somebody else must be exploited. That's only true whenever there's political power and force employed. You know, if a government sends its army to conquer and take over a colony, that might well be zero sum, but it rests upon the use of force, not things like private property and voluntary contract and individual consent.
That's another great thing about the free market. It has the most vital regulation on earth that the state doesn't have, the freedom to disassociate with bad actors and stop funding them. So for all this talk about the need for regulation, they never allow us to stop funding bad actors. Do you think when someone says that, all right, so I see people with a lot of power and a lot of money and people sort of just getting by, therefore, these people with a lot of access to resources can abuse, manipulate these people that have less institutional power. Therefore, some state regulation is justified, or not even some, quite a bit is justified to stop this power imbalance from spiraling into something totally unjustified. How would you respond to that general theory of the need for regulation or antitrust?
Well, I would start by saying, look, you've just made a very nebulous and general postulate there by saying, for the broadest and most general of reasons, because somebody might take advantage of another, because one has more than the other, we therefore must have some or a lot or who knows how much regulation. I would say, wait a minute, I can't make a decision based on that. That doesn't tell me anything. For what purpose? Do you want regulation just for the sake of it? Just because somebody, this guy's big, this guy's little? Or do you want to define the offense in some way. And that's where much of antitrust law comes up wanting, because it doesn't really define the, going way back to the very first antitrust laws, it doesn't clearly define the kind of conduct that is offensive or violative of people's rights that should be punished. The original Sherman Act, for instance, the first antitrust act of 1890, it just basically said, well, the government can intervene when this guy gets big. And it never said, you know, well, what if he gets big by the fact that customers love what he produces and he makes better stuff and more of it than anybody else? He's being rewarded in the marketplace. I mean, we have people in athletics and show business all the time who capture huge audiences of willing customers and get rich because of it. Not because they've bludgeoned anybody. They've added to wealth. They've created something that other people willingly choose to buy. So when it comes to antitrust law, I think it's on very thin ice if it doesn't define the kind of conduct that a person would know in advance, okay, I can't do that because that violates the rights of other people to property and contract and so forth. Too much antitrust law is just vague. That's why I remember when I used to teach, one of the many examples of stupid antitrust law I used was from the Federal Trade Commission that one time sued the five big ready-to-eat cereal manufacturers like Kellogg and General Mills and General Foods and Quaker Oats. And there were five. And the FTC claimed that those five cereal makers, ready-to-eat cereal makers, had a shared monopoly of 80% of the ready-to-eat cereal market. And they thought, they said, well, 80%, that's just by definition too big. But, you know, there are a lot of problems with that. But one is, wait a minute, how do you define the market here? If you define it as ready-to-eat cereal, those five manufacturers, there's still five of them, by the way, there's not one. Those five, they do sound pretty big. Wow, 80%. But if you define the market they're in not as the ready-to-eat cereal market, but rather the breakfast market, well, then you discover they're a lot smaller. I used to ask my students, okay, what'd you have for breakfast this morning? And somebody would say, well, I had bacon and eggs. Oh, well, there's competition for the cereal manufacturers. somebody else says, well, I had pancakes. Okay, there's more competition. Somebody else says, I had a Coke and a cigarette. Well, there's competition. So anyway, you're getting me on my soapbox here. But a lot of antitrust law is just nebulous mumbo jumbo, feel good stuff from people who just don't like bigness in business, whether it's doing good or not.
There is another justification for state intervention. That is people, all right, you've dismissed the greed argument. Well, people are ignorant. Therefore, they don't know what a good computer is like, or a good microphone, or a good house, or a good airplane. Therefore, the state is much more of a third party arbitrating what otherwise could be something faulty. So even if it's not because of greed, maybe it's just because you, the consumer, don't have the information. Does the existence of, let's say, large-scale ignorance justify regulation or state intervention?
No, I don't think so. In fact, anytime I feel as though I need a little bit more information to make a good choice in the marketplace, the last person I think of is my local politician, or even, and the next to last is the one, or even further than last is the one that's 2,000 miles away. I mean, who in their right mind says, wow, I'm not sure which restaurant to go to. Let's call our congressman. I mean, that's it's ridiculous. In the marketplace, there information is being provided too. Not only goods are provided, but information about those goods. So you have consumer reports, you have TripAdvisor, you have, you know, endless ways in which we as shoppers in the marketplace can gather information before we make a decision. And that's almost never government. It's almost always the trusted private entities that we turn to for information.
Do you ever read history and see such overlap with what is referred to as the colonialist mindset of only we can really civilize these people once we go in there and straighten things up with today? these dumb consumers don't know what to do, so we got to regulate them. The evil businesses, we're just going to fix them up. Well, do you see that there's so much overlap? And has there been any intellectual or moral progress made with the ideas of freedom and voluntary association?
Oh, that's a great question. And yes, I have seen that throughout history. It shows up in a lot of different forms. One of the endless struggles that good humans of good character engage in is to tamp down their arrogance, to recognize how little they really know, how humble they should be. That was one of the lessons of Leonard Reed's great essay, I, Pencil. Nobody even knows how to make a pencil, let alone run an economy. So, throughout history, you see in various forms this attitude of some people that, oh, well, I'm special. I happen to know more, and I need to take care of these other people. Sometimes those other people that you think are dumb and ignorant, they're a lot smarter than you think they are. You see this in education, for instance. A lot of people think, oh, we can't let parents have more choices when it comes to where their kids should be educated. They might make the wrong choice. So those same people want the government to monopolize education as if government officials will never make the wrong choice, you know. And yet we have in government schools every year millions of kids who fall through the cracks. The cracks that are erected, subsidized, paid for, and otherwise constructed by these nanny state arrogant politicians who think they know best for everybody. Most of the time, the overwhelming share of the time, they don't. It's just a show. It's just part of the game. It's the claim they make because they think they just like the fact that if the government is big, then maybe they'll get to run it and tell the rest of us what to do.
One of my favorite debate moments was Larkin Rose, a libertarian activist, debating Tom Willicutt, a PhD. So just sit back and listen mostly. And Willicutt's so frustrated that he's sort of behind on this. He goes, you know, Larkin, I live in the real world. We need government because I don't trust people. And Larkin goes, what species do you want running the government?
Yeah, that's a great
you
point.
You don't trust people, therefore a subset of people should rule the rest of us. It's ridiculous. Don Boudreau makes the great point of people are so dumb that we need to regulate them. By the way, everyone needs to vote. Democracy is inherently good. Everyone must have a say in everyone else's life all the time, every 2, 4, and 6 years. Well, what a contradiction is that, where people are both dumb consumers and brilliant voters. How has that contradiction been pushed on the masses? I guess I'm not giving you a lot of wiggle room with that. Do you see anything inherently valuable with regard to democracy or large-scale voting?
Well, you know, if we're going to have a government, and certainly if we're going to have one, I would advocate it be very, very small. that's another topic. But if we're going to have one, well, then I don't think I want one where one guy or a handful of powerful people get to tell everybody what to do. I think I would want a government in which the broad public has some say, whether it be by their power to vote at the ballot box or to run for office themselves. I mean, I prefer what is called democracy over dictatorship. But, you know, pure democracy would be an absolute mind-blowing piece of nonsense. Pure democracy would be, we don't recognize anybody's rights. Everything's up for a vote. Mm-hmm. And majority plus 50% plus one gets to decide everything, even whether or not you ought to have a right to something. We don't have that, I'm thankful for. We have a republic with democratic features. You can run for office, you can vote, but you can't vote to wipe away somebody else's rights, or you shouldn't be allowed to have that opportunity anyway. So I see democracy as the big saving grace of democracy is not that it guarantees good government. It doesn't. You can vote yourself into slavery. And we are in the process, I think, of doing that in America. The one saving grace of democracy is it allows for change without violence. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a dictatorship, well, then the people, they may move in one direction in their thinking. And the dictator, meanwhile, sits over here, never changing at all. And the only way you can get him to change is to overthrow him. to go in the streets, have violence. And at least democracy allows for change without guns, without violence, but it doesn't in any way guarantee positive change. You can vote yourself into slavery.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the things that I like the most, whether it's printers, iPads, books, my favorite movies, my favorite TV shows, you know, very high-tech televisions and smartphones. They weren't necessarily the result of people voting or even cooperatives. They were much more the result of voluntary, what you could call the Pareto principle or the iron law of oligarchy. Do you think it's okay for society to have some amount of inequality, or maybe even a great deal, because it allows people to flourish and have more of an imprint than they otherwise would if we strictly focused on egalitarianism?
Well, if you mean by equality, equality in material things, there is a measure or a kind of equality that I strongly support, and that is equality before the law. Mm-hmm. The idea that you should be judged innocent or guilty if you're accused of something based upon whether you did it, not according to your race, your sex, your gender, or any number of other irrelevant things. But in material things, income and possessions, no society can ever or will ever achieve equality, and no society should ever want it, because we are different. We're not robots. We're not all the same. And the combination of things that make each of us up, talents and our ambitions, our goals, our willingness to work and save and so forth, that's all so different one person to another. Why should we ever expect that the outcome in the marketplace of exchange would be equal incomes? I mean, why should I make the same at playing basketball than Michael Jordan used to make? Or, you know, endless examples of I don't have the talent or the willingness to persevere or the desire to save or any whatever it takes to be the kind of entrepreneur that person X or Y may be. And so they may earn more than me. Well, more power to them. I'm not going to go through life looking upon their success with envy. I mean, that just drags a person down. So I will rejoice when other people are successful, when that success arises from free and voluntary exchange, the application of their talents, being there first, coming up with a new idea. I mean, that's the kind of thing I want to encourage. And I don't care if they earn more than me. I rejoice in that.
And even we can benefit directly from people's, you know, genius being free to, you know, engage in whatever activities they'd like. The fact that I can buy CDs from Marshall Mathers and Adele and Dave Matthews, I know everyone grills me for loving them, but the great books that I enjoy reading, Henry Hazlitt, it gives me the ability to access their wisdom through mm-hmm. voluntary exchange and specialization in the division of labor. What do you think is the most overlooked insight that but people like Adam Smith and Ludwig von Mises gave us when looking into the specialization and division of labor in society?
The most overlooked insight?
Yes, or something valuable about the division of labor, just because I see so often it's underappreciated. Everyone has to be an expert in everything. You know, in order to pass this law, everyone needs to spend thousands of hours away from what they're doing so we can look at the next bill Congress has proposed.
Yeah. I'm constantly amazed, especially as the economy grows and becomes ever more complex, how minute the division of labor sometimes become, how some people are so extraordinarily good at finding a very tiny niche where they could apply some unique talent or insight, and the end result is a new good or a service that so many people want that person becomes wealthy. I just think that's an amazing thing. And the people who spend their lives just denigrating that, who like to point to such people and say, you didn't build that, or you have too much, I just think that's more of a commentary on their own moral sadness than anything else. I think we should be a society of people who rejoice in the contributions that other people make when they do so through the free and voluntary process of the marketplace. So There was something else on that, but now I forgot what it was. Anyway, hope
let
I
me
answered.
Know if it comes back to you.
Okay.
A book titled The Road to Serfdom by F.A. Hayek, he says,
Here comes. Before you go, Keith, just holding that book up made me think of that other thing I was going to say. You asked about an overlooked insight. This one isn't overlooked, certainly among my friends in the economics world, but it is in society at large. And that is an insight from Hayek. So beautifully expressed and expressed in that famous line where he said, "It is the curious task of economics to convince men or to demonstrate to men how little they know about what they imagine they can design."
Mm.
Now, oh my gosh, I think that is so full of wisdom. You have to really think about that. And if you do, you'll come up with all kinds of ancillary insights. But the task, the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they know about what they imagine they can design. Oh my gosh. I mean, he's basically saying that you ain't as smart as you think you are if you're the central planner type who thinks he knows everything. And then you put that fact alongside of this marvelous, spontaneous, natural mechanism that we call the marketplace with its resource-directing price system and so forth. It is just so underappreciated what happens when free people are left alone and these magical forces of the marketplace come into play. Hayek, I think, distilled that so beautifully into that great phrase. It's one of my favorites, certainly my favorite of Hayek's.
Oh, yeah. And the small amount of knowledge. People will so often look at, a football team is a lot of people working together, but playing solitaire is something, you know, that just is one person. Well, no, because it's on your computer, which you didn't build.
Exactly.
It's with electricity you didn't build. You're in a house you didn't build. You're alive because you ate food, so you could play solitaire, which you didn't grow. So it's constant. Even if you think, all right, something so dumb and simple, a pencil, solitaire. It's like, nope, a lot of other people went into that. I just want to do one more thing on the why the worst get on top. On page 160, Hayek says, "Here comes, in the second negative principle of selection, he will be able to obtain the support of all the docile and gullible who have no strong convictions of their own, but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. It will be those whose vague and imperfectly formed ideas are easily swayed and whose passions and emotions are readily aroused who will thus swell the ranks of the totalitarian party." Mr. Yeah. Reed, why do the worst rise to the top?
Well, I think that is especially true in the public sector. And Hayek, I think, was trying to make that point. I mean, certainly you have sometimes really bad people get to the top of a private institution. But that tends to be sooner or later self-correcting. At least you have an easier time getting rid of most bad apples in the private sector than you do in the public sector most of the time. There are plenty of exceptions. But I think the worst get to the top in the public sector, by the way, I should point out, and that should be of greatest concern to us because the public sector, by definition, means where you have a monopoly of legal force. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have a bad guy gets in charge of McDonald's, but what's the worst he can do? Force you to eat a Big Mac? He can't even do that, you know. But in the public sector, the worst get to the top for a lot of reasons. One, they tend to be it's the demagogues that get rewarded so often. The ones who say to the crowd, don't worry about tomorrow. Live for today. I'll get it for you. I mean, there are lots of people who will fall for that. But it's a very short-sighted demagogic view. And if you're a person who already loves the idea of power, where are you going to go? You're going to go into government because that's where you get it. And power is corrupting, as we mentioned earlier. So I think if you're a bad person to begin with, you'll probably be a lot more comfortable in the public sector, especially if you're in the bureaucracy, which tends to be kind of permanent and relatively unaccountable. So, I think our founders here in America understood that one of the many reasons for keeping government small is the bigger it is, the more the nastiest of people will gravitate towards it. And what concerns me more than anything else is that we are in the process today of combining two great evils, bad people with big government. They can do a lot of harm.
One of my favorite Mises quotes is in bureaucracy. He says, the real bosses in the capitalist system of market economy are the consumers. They, by their buying and by their abstention from buying, decide who should own the capital and run the plants. They determine what should be produced and in what quality and quantity. Their attitudes result either in profit or loss for the enterpriser. They make poor men rich and rich men poor. They are no easy bosses. If I find myself in a free market society without the ability to vote for politicians to work on my behalf, how can I influence society when I don't have the mechanism of democracy?
Well, you probably are not going to be able to do it just by jumping on a stump somewhere and giving a stupid speech, because people are going to say, well, what's he going to do for me? You know. Yeah. If you want to be a person of influence and you don't have ready access to government to do it, well, then you're going to find you've got to start offering people things that they want. You better find a talent that you have and put it to use. You better create something. You better add to the wealth of society. You better offer something to somebody which will prompt them then to say, hey, that's a great thing. Give me that. I'll trade with you for that. That's how you become a person of influence, by in effect serving the desires of other people in a free marketplace. What a great insight that was of Mises's that you read, because he's paying tribute there to something that you really didn't have for hundreds of years before capitalism unlocked it, and that was the power of consumer choice. You know, if this were 1200, the year 1200, I mean, it would make no sense to talk about consumer sovereignty. I mean, you ate what the lord of the manor let you eat, or what the king of the realm let you have. And the very notion that, consumers will run the show instead of people with political power was unheard of then. What a different and better world it is today because of that.
Just one more fine-tuning point on that. How do you respond to the free market is simply a fake philosophy useful idiots buy into and is in the interests of big business?
Well, I would say, that sounds like it's coming from somebody who's never really thought very deeply about it, that person is into bumper stickers rather than deal with the argument, rather than deal with things like history and logic and experience and economics. They want to take an entire profession of economics or an entire aspect of life, entrepreneurship, and simply dismiss it with a flippant turn of the phrase. That's not scholarly. They should be ashamed if that's their tactic. It doesn't prove anything.
If I fear big business running my life into the ground, why should I support the free market? Won't they just go into a free market and use anything at their disposal to sort of run amok?
That's a lot more easily said than it is ever done. If you go through life worrying not about the politicians with political power who can throw you behind bars, but the people who actually make stuff and offer it to you, then I'd say you've got some mixed up priorities. Even the most principled advocate of the free market, I'd like to think I'm one of them. We never sanction things like theft or dishonesty or deception or fraud or force or violence. We'd say no matter who is committing those sins, throw the book at them. We should have appropriate penalties for people who use those things to invade the rights and the lives of other people. But if you're peacefully creating wealth and offering things in exchange to people, the rest of us should say, more power to you. Great, thanks. I'll trade with you if I want to, or I'll buy from a competitor, or I'll start a business myself. But in any event, you're not the enemy.
People will often critique the free market and saying, well, you Westerners are disproportionately Christian. The biggest symbol of Christianity is Jesus Christ, often promoting things like compassion, caring for your neighbor, making sure that people know it's easier for a camel to get into a needle than a rich person to get into heaven. Therefore, Jesus is actually socialist and capitalism is much more Luciferian. You wrote an excellent book called Jesus was Jesus a socialist?
Yes.
Please answer that question.
Was okay.
Jesus a socialist?
The answer is hell no.
Why?
I have scoured the New Testament, which records many words of Jesus, and have yet to find even the most remote suggestion from his lips that he would endorse the ethics or the economics of socialism. He never advocated for the aggrandizement of earthly political power. He never advocated for the forcible redistribution of wealth. When the 5,000 came to hear him speak and they were hungry, he didn't say to his disciples, well, there's a rich neighborhood somewhere nearby. Let's go loot the neighborhood and bring their money here so I can give it to these people. No, he used his unique power to create new wealth. He didn't pilfer a crumb from anybody, which he would have done had he been a socialist. There was a man who approached him. This is recorded in the book of Luke, chapter 12, who says to Jesus, Master, speak to my brother that he divideth the inheritance with me. In other words, hey, use your power to redistribute the wealth. I don't think I got as much as I should have. And Jesus did not say anything like, well, look into it. Oh, what? You didn't get the same as the other guy? No, he rebuked the man for his envy and then said this. And don't you wish every politician would someday say this and mean it sincerely? He said, man, who made me a judge or divider over you? Who made me a judge or divider over you? In his various parables that have economic content, invariably they support things like voluntary contract and private property, even supply and demand. So this idea that he was a socialist, I mean, we just barely scratched the surface there, but it's absolute, unsupportable nonsense.
And you can just scroll through the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not steal. All right, socialism refuted. Thank you.
It
says it very clear. Because to assume theft can exist is to assume that private property or at least self-ownership exists. Because if there is no such thing as property, well, then you can't steal.
It's just logically impossible. Jesus said he came to uphold the law. He was a great defender of the Ten Commandments. And the eighth one that you alluded to, Keith, says, thou shalt not steal, period. It doesn't say, thou shalt not steal unless the other guy has more than you do, or thou shalt not steal unless you're just absolutely sure you can spend it better than the guy that earned it.
Thou shalt not steal unless next quarter's GDP figures are 3% higher. Speaking of the Keynesians, here is Paul Krugman in The Conscience of a Liberal, page 35. What is remarkable, in a way, is how many years of depression it took before the federal government was prepared to take similar action. Herbert Hoover had made his name with post-war relief efforts in Europe, yet he dug his heels against any major attempt to provide aid at home in the face of national crisis. You wrote a book called Great Myths of the Great Depression. Where is Paul Krugman wrong?
Oh my gosh, let me count the ways. Krugman, like so many of the so-called progressive left, they like to think that Herbert Hoover was a laissez-faire, hands-off, stand-pat president who didn't do anything, and that Roosevelt, when things got bad enough, had to come in and intervene all over the place to save us. Nothing could be further from the truth. Herbert Hoover jacked up taxes dramatically with the Revenue Act of 1932. He took the top rate from 24% to 65% in one fell swoop. 2 years before that, in 1930, with the onset of a recession, he made it a depression by signing into law the Smoot-Hawley tariff that raised tariffs, taxes on imports to an all-time high and virtually closed the borders. He had a Reconstruction Finance Corporation throwing subsidies at businesses. He had all kinds of relief agencies. In fact, Roosevelt's own brain trusters, more than one of them later in various ways, said that all Roosevelt had done was do what Hoover did on steroids and raise taxes even further. In fact, you know, in 1932, when Roosevelt ran against Hoover, the rap on Hoover that he issued was that Hoover was an interventionist president who's jacking up taxes and tariffs, and he attacked Hoover for, quote, leading the country down the path to socialism. You know, he was right in the campaign, but then he did more of the same once he became president. And as a result, the Depression lingered for another 7 years. And it wasn't Roosevelt that ended it. It wasn't even World War II that ended it. What finally brought it to an end more than anything else and brought about broad-based increases in the standard of living, which occurred in 45, 46, were things like the reduction in the business income tax rate from 90% to 38%. And the massive reduction in government spending. This is something you'll never hear from Krugman. Krugman, as a Keynesian, you know, would love to say, oh, when government spends more, it stimulates, as if it's a magical fairy. But when it cuts its spending, it hurts. Okay, well, what about after World War II, we had the most dramatic reduction in federal spending in American history, largely through demobilization, demilitarization. Biggest reduction in federal spending ever. Did we have a renewed depression? No, because all those resources were now released from an unproductive and destructive public sector for the productive private sector to put to good use. So Krugman is not so much an economist as he is a propagandist.
Well, and all you have to do is look at the numbers. You can look at, I was not able to find my copy of your excellent book, but I know I've read it. But I found Steve Horwitz's summary of it, and he cites the revenue of the U.S. government in 1929, $3.3 billion. 1933, Hoover's last year, $6.5 billion. First of all, look at how far we've come. Second of all, he almost doubled it. Almost doubled spending, and he's called, a non-interventionist, just like Obama is called an isolationist when he goes into Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Pakistan and expands the Afghan war. It's never enough. It's never enough with these people. So often they will say, well, there's two sorts of government programs, ones that work and ones that just need more funding. When you're dealing with someone like that, when you're dealing with someone like that, how do you explain to them on principle the state is not a mechanism to achieve your ends economically, nor is it justified morally?
Yeah. Oh, great question. Well, I try to point out several things. That first of all, government is not the tooth fairy. It has nothing to give anybody except what it first takes from somebody. And it takes it either from present taxpayers or future taxpayers by loading them with debt that they have to pay off so we get our current gratification. It's not like it just appears out of nowhere and supplies us with, magical wealth. I mean, it's a redistributive agency that sucks off an awful lot of bureaucratic brokerage fee to get its jobs done at everybody's expense. So I might have got a little off the track there. I've forgotten.
Yes. But one way to sort of expand on this is, let's just say I just care about the poor. Maybe it's a little free market we could use. Maybe it's some government. I'm looking for the principled response as opposed to the, let's see what works. And then you point out to them that it doesn't work and they go, well, it just needs more funding. So if I just care about helping the impoverished, whether it's the poor in America or poor Haitians and Guatemalans, why should I promote or accept the principles of free market capitalism?
Well, because the principles of free market capitalism tell us a lot about whether you really mean it. I mean, if you're just sitting there saying, oh, I want to help the poor and I want to do that by asking the politicians to do it, in a free market, we would say, wait a minute, that's, you're just abdicating whatever responsibility you claim that you have or anybody else has by pawning it off onto politicians and empowering them to seize money that doesn't belong to them. That doesn't tell me really what's in your heart at all. In fact, if you look at progressives today or leftists, you'll find they're incessantly calling for higher taxes, especially on people they like to vilify. Because they think the government, once it gets the money, will spend it on wonderful things, helping people. Well, what's to stop them right now from writing a bigger check themselves? I mean, there's nothing in law that says you can't make a contribution to the government beyond what your taxes require. But those who have the most faith in government, they never line up to do that. So the reason that's important is it makes you wonder, well, maybe their objective isn't what they say it is, which is, government helping people. Maybe their objective is government punishing people. they want the government to take from the people they don't like, and whether or not they actually help anybody with it is secondary.
At least their intentions are good. Yes, forget about
they want you to think they are.
That's gonna be my new move from now on. I'm just gonna hand the table next to me the bill at the restaurant and say, "I swear to God, my intentions are good. They're like the greatest intentions you guys have ever heard of. I won't even bore you with them. Have a good one."
That's right. Tell these people to start living their lives the way they keep telling us we're supposed to live ours. Put their money where their mouths are.
Yeah. As far as playing what Ayn Rand called the argument from intimidation. They will sometimes try and poison the well and say, you know, a lot of these ideas have insidious origins, and then they connect them to the Koch brothers, or the word privatization was actually used with national socialists, and school choice is actually a racist origin idea. You had a great article on the origins of the welfare state, also known as the nanny state. What are the origins of the nanny state?
The modern welfare state, keeping in mind that there are welfare states of the distant past, Rome set one up late in its republic, and it was a major reason why its republic fell into chaos and dictatorship and financial insolvency. But the more recent modern welfare state is usually attributed to Otto von Bismarck. He was the Iron Chancellor, as he was known, of Germany. The man who, more than anybody else, consolidated a couple dozen German states in 1871 into the German Empire. And then he went on for the next 20 years as chancellor. And a few years into that tenure, he decided he wanted to buy off a big chunk of the electorate. He saw some of them gravitating to the socialists. And he thought, oh my gosh, the way to fight socialism is to be a socialist myself and just be there first, offering other people's money and hopefully doing it better than the socialists ever will. That was his idea. It was not like, oh, I just want to be Mother Teresa and help people. No, he inaugurated the welfare state, making the people dependent upon the state because he saw it as a route to maintaining power himself. That's what it was all about. And that's what a lot of welfare statists in Washington have in mind. They don't give a damn for you so much. They want to be in power and being in charge of, you know, grabbing a lot of money from these people and giving it to those people, buying their votes with it. That's power for them. And that's what motivates them, not compassion. Otherwise, they'd be giving more generously of their own substance.
What are some real world examples of the philosophy you advocate leading to large amounts of wealth and decreases in poverty and increases in leisure time?
Oh, there are many. Here's a great example from right after World War II. Think of Germany, 1945, defeated, demoralized, occupied, divided, hyperinflation, economic ruin, 12 years behind them of Hitler's socialism. The place is an absolute devastated mess for any number of reasons, of course, losing the war being one of them. So what do you do in a case like that? Everybody needs economic growth. Well, Great Britain went down the socialist path and later paid an awful price for that. It had to be undone to a great extent. But in Germany, there was a man named Ludwig Erhard, who became ultimately a finance minister, but worked his way up. While the Allies were still occupying Germany in the late 40s, Erhard, who was a believer in economic freedom, he went on radio on a Sunday and said to the German people, okay, we're getting rid of controls, regulations, we're cutting taxes, we're implementing a sound currency, we're going to go the free market route, we're going to get rid of all this socialism crap. And what were people the world over talking about within 10 years? The phrase was the German economic miracle. A country that was so flattened by its defeat and occupation and division after World War II, within a decade becomes an economic powerhouse again. They didn't do it through socialism. That's nothing more than taking the pie and crumbling it up into different sized chunks. But he created new wealth by getting off the backs of people and allowing creativity to blossom. It's just a great example. Hong Kong is another one. After the war, they only had 750,000 people. on that rock, and they were very poor. And the mother country, Great Britain at the time, decided to go the socialist route, but a man named John James Copperthwaite, a Scot, who was in charge of the administration of Hong Kong, he says, no, we can't do that. We're just a rock. There's nothing to divide. We got to create wealth. So he cut taxes. He got the government out of one area of enterprise after another. Hong Kong became and remained for 30 years or more the freest economy in the world. And what happened? It became an economic powerhouse. Socialists have nothing like that they can point to. They can't say, oh, over here, capitalism made a terrible poverty-stricken mess, and then we adopted socialism and fixed it. Oh, there's no such example. But there are a lot of examples like Hong Kong and in Germany that show free markets can fix even the worst of situations.
Well, you're about to be sorry, because both Sean Penn, Michael Moore, and Noam Chomsky are very excited about what Hugo Chavez is going to do in Venezuela. He has brought power to the people.
Yes. Oh,
just keep an eye on the news. You're going to hear about that economic powerhouse any day now. Couple final questions. What is your elevator pitch to people on the right? The free market does not allow me to embrace the finer things in life. It's all about money and corruption and can lead to degeneracy. Why should I, as a right winger, embrace free markets? I just need an elevator pitch.
I like to bring character into it. I like to tell them that free markets and individual liberty, that's the only social, political, economic arrangement that requires that we live to high standards of character. That's a good thing. It's the only system that says, look, you can't have the good things of life if you and lots of other people are not people of good character. If you are not honest, if you're irresponsible, if you're unhumble, if you're timid, you will lose your freedoms, and with it, you will lose your economic lives. But liberty and capitalism, free markets, that means we respect each other. We respect our rights, our lives, our property, our choices. We understand that diversity is a wonderful thing. We don't vilify people just because we think they have more than we do. We rejoice in their success and try to achieve it themselves. Isn't that an uplifting philosophy? Or do you want to get mired in a terribly enervating philosophy of envy and tearing people down, taking their stuff, and empowering stupid politicians to run their lives? How dumb. Don't do that.
If I'm someone on the left focusing very much on justice, equality, both of opportunity and outcome, racial justice, gender justice, what is your elevator pitch to me so I will be open to considering the free market philosophy?
I would say you've got to get past those bumper stickers and think fundamentally about things like what makes an individual entitled to rights to life and property, and why are those things important? And once you do, you start to see people for what they really are. They're unique individuals. You don't think of them as, you know, lumps of something or groups with group rights. The more you understand and appreciate humanity, the more you realize the individuality of each of us. Stop looking at the snowstorm and look at the snowflakes, because everyone is different.
Excellent. Who are some of your biggest influences?
My former professor at Grove City College, Dr. Hans Senholz, a great Austrian economist, was a huge influence to me. Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education, great influence. My own father was a great influence on the character side, because by his example, he impressed upon me at an early age how important it was to treat people right, fairly, and with respect, and not to lord it over them because you think you're smarter than they are. Those are three of the biggest. But there are people of history, of course, that I never met that had great influence. We talked about Cicero. His bravery in the face of the collapse of the Roman Republic really is so inspiring to me. And great entrepreneurs who never run to the government asking for any favors. Those are people I admire, too.
Final question. What is, let's just say, one book? See, I'd love to recommend multiple books, but if you recommend five, people will get zero. If there is one book you would like, let's say, everyone to read, whether they're left, right, libertarian, what is one book you would recommend everyone read?
I think it would have to be Frederick Bastiat's The Law. He certainly comes to a firm conclusion and a lot of very firm ones along the way as well. But nobody, I think, ever more clearly explained what law is supposed to be and what it shouldn't be than Frederick Bastiat. What a remarkable man. So that would be it, The Law. And it's an easy read. You can read it in an evening. It's not 500 pages.
Excellent, excellent pick. Mr. Reed, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find your archive of books, articles, and quotes?
They can find everything at lawrencewreed.com. That's LAWRENCE, middle initial W, last name RWED, no punctuation, lawrencewreed.com.
Thank you to everyone for watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and the Libertarian Institute. Thank you, Mr. Reed, for your time.